Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 156 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If you're a word nerd like me, you find the origins of words endlessly fascinating. I'm always compulsively dropping trivia about etymology on unsuspecting friends and loved ones, so of course I'm going to jump at the opportunity to talk about a new book that introduces Old English words to modern audiences through the lens of everyday life. This week, I invited Dr. Hannah Vaideen to speak with me about her book, The Word Hoard, Daily Life in Old English. Hannah is a medievalist after my own heart who creates online content for the public around her work on Old English, including an app called Word Hoard App, which sends Old English words every day straight to your phone. Our conversation on what makes Old English different, what makes it beautiful, and what some of our favorite words are is coming up right after this. You've probably heard of the publisher Boydell and Brewer, friends of this podcast who often participate in Medievalist.net's book club on Patreon. This week, our friends at Boydell want to let you know about the new paperback version of their classic book, Runes, a Handbook, by Michael P. Barnes. This book covers the history and origin of runes, Viking Age and medieval runes, formal inscriptions as well as graffiti, cryptic inscriptions, a glossary of terms, an index of where to find inscriptions in Scandinavia, and a section on runes in literature and politics. It also provides photos so that you can see examples of these runes for yourself. The Times Literary Supplement says it tells the reader everything he or she needs to know about runes and how to study them. Runes, a Handbook, is now available in paperback at boydellandbrewer.com. Well, thank you so much, Hannah, for coming on to talk about Old English. I love this type of stuff, so it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We were talking a second ago, and I'm going to ask you the same question I just asked you, but you're talking about Old English. And you're specifically calling it Old English. Now, here in Canada, we just had a politician who dropped the phrase Anglo-Saxon words. And what he meant was plain speech, I think. But what went through your mind when he said that?
Well, there are a couple things. First of all, if he is talking about Old English, he probably isn't thinking of Huatwe Gardena and Yerdagum, Theodpininga Thrumi Frunum. That's probably not the language that he is thinking of using with his potential voters. Old English is specifically the language that was used in England from around 550 to 1150, and it's actually quite foreign to even fluent native English speakers today. But secondly, the term Anglo-Saxon isn't an accurate or an appropriate term to be using anyway to refer to this period. Anglo-Saxon isn't actually used for self-identifying people in that time period. And it actually came into use more in like the 19th century, the 18th and 19th century, sort of with the rise of English imperialism and colonialism. And it's used to sort of promote this idea of a superior white race that sort of has the right to take over the world because they're superior in some ways. So yeah, it's a racist term at its roots. A lot of people today think that it's been co-opted by white supremacists recently, but it's actually been racist for ever since the term was used originally. So yeah, I don't use it in my book, consequently.
Yeah, absolutely. So when someone's using Anglo-Saxon when they're talking about words, first of all, the words that they're talking about are going to be unrecognizable, which is something that we're going to talk about. But also, it's not a term that we tend to use in scholarship all that much these days. It's not a term that I tend to use. So when we're talking about that language, we're talking about Old English. Okay, so let's get to it. When we talk about Old English, you gave us a taste of it a second ago. Are we talking about Shakespeare? That's the question that everyone always asks, right? What, Old English, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I often get that when I tell people about the fact that I research Old English. Usually people are a bit confused about what that is. Shakespeare is actually early modern English. And sometimes people suggest, oh, you mean Chaucer, but Chaucer is actually Middle English. Mm-hmm. And Old English is earlier than both of those. It's the language that we encounter in the poem Beowulf. And it's the language that was used in England primarily before the Norman conquest. So it doesn't have all of the influences of French, It also has less Latin influence as well. It's more of a Germanic language vocabulary that we have.
Yeah, we have some clues as to how to pronounce it, which is always tricky. But when you pronounce it, it almost sounds, sometimes some words sound like English that's kind of skewed. So it doesn't even sound like what we would say now. I remember when I was learning it, the rule of thumb was French vowels in English consonants. So you have to kind of twist your vowels to fit it. So one of the major differences, I think, between what we know of as modern English and old English is letters, right? The letters are not even the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you look at the first few lines of Beowulf and you immediately see letters that we don't use anymore, like ash, which is the A and the E that are smushed together and has an A sound. But we also have thorn and edd. Thorn is kind of like a P with the sidebar going up higher, sort of like a lowercase P and a B combined. Mm-hmm. And then the edd sort of looks like a D with a crossbar. And those both make TH sounds. We don't have those anymore either. Those are quite surprising if you haven't read Old English in the original before.
Yeah, and reading it in the original takes a lot of work. But thorn is something that has caused some trouble, right? When you see pubs and stuff, that's one of the places where you start the book. Thorn, the remnants of thorn, you see them in places where people are trying to throw back. So how does that work?
Yeah, so one of the things that I love that I started out the book talking about was that when you see ye olde signs, which is written to evoke this medieval time, the ye is actually, it actually comes from thorn, because when printing presses started to be used after the Middle Ages, they used the letter Y to indicate the letter thorn. They were very similar. And the way thorn was written could sometimes look like Y in handwriting as well. So if you were writing the word the, then you would write thorn E, which would be T-H-E. So the way we think of the, but because this other character was being used, people saw it as ye, and they forgot the original reason to be writing it that way. And it sort of caught on and became this way of referring to the past, even though it was never used to say ye.
This is one of these things, I'm laughing because this is one of these things that now people who listen to the podcast are going to have in their minds anytime they go to, you know, a quote unquote Renaissance fair, they're going to see this yield. And it's going to be a thorn in their brains. But that is one of the hazards of being a medievalist. No, everyone can share the joy. So originally, Old English is also a runic language. So how did runes work when it comes to writing Old English? Can you tell us about runes?
Yeah. So before the Latin or Roman alphabet was used in England, there was this runic alphabet, which scholars later on call Futhark, but we don't know what people actually called it at the time. That's just the name that was assigned by future scholars. And it's made up of a series of straight lines. So they'd be easy to carve into wood or stone or bone is sort of the idea. And each rune represents a letter and a sound, but it also represents a word or concept, which is one of the things I love about Old English. Is so you could write the letter F, which is the first letter of the runic alphabet. It's called Feo, and Feo means that rune, the F rune, but it also means cattle or wealth. So even after runes weren't used anymore because of the Latin alphabet, they weren't really needed as much, you still get them scattered in Old English manuscripts where, you know, a poet will decide to throw in the M rune, which is mon, and it means man or person or human being. It's really interesting. We don't have that in our alphabet today. We can't write a letter A and have people just think, oh, that means apple, and, you know, on its own mean apple. So yeah.
Yeah, that's true. We don't have anything that signals, like if you write a B, it doesn't mean a concept of like wealth.
Yeah.
Or maybe there's one that I'm missing, but I can't think of one like that. I really like that about runes too. When you see them, people are playing with them when they're actually writing things down. So they mean a word, they're writing a word, but they also mean a whole bunch of concepts put together. And I love that ingenuity in the way people play with language, with runes. One of the examples that you have in the book is a signature that is part of a poem, right?
Yeah. So I talk about runic signatures, which are very uncommon in Old English, but they are really neat. The poet Cynewulf, part of the reason that we know that there's this one poet called Cynewulf who wrote these poems is because he signs his work, and he does this by including a series of runes sort of interspersed in his poetry at the very end of the poem usually. And he uses the runes to express the concept. So he uses the L rune, for instance, Lago, he's referring to water or ocean. But at the same time, by using those sequence of runes, he's spelling out his name, which is really fun. Although it also feels a bit contrived at times. I mean, you have to use a certain series of words at the end of your poem every time. And there's only so much you can do with that in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that you were pointing out in the book that it says like joy and it's water, but he's like trying to make the joy like enclosed in water. And I was like, what does that actually mean?
It's a bit of a stretch. And then I tried to do it for myself, and that really doesn't work very well, because that means I have to sign off with hail, oak tree, mead, and then oak tree again. I don't know. I tried ending a chapter that way, and I would say it was not a success. So I don't recommend it.
It was fun though. It was fun trying to see you like put oak in there twice. What does this actually mean? How does this work? But it's fun to see these concepts working together. And one of the things that I really like about Old English is this playfulness and the idea of these compound words. I feel like that is something that we could use more of. Like, speaking of ways that Old English has gone to the past, these compound words are one of my favorite things about it. And ones that are probably my favorite are ones that work with win, which is a rune, but it also means joy. And putting these things together that explain what kind of joy you're feeling at that time is one of my favorites.
Yeah, I love that too. And I mentioned the word wundream, which means wun and dream are both words meaning joy. So it's like having double joy, which is just, it's a lovely concept. It was actually interesting. I was looking into this recently about different compounds with sort of emotions. The word of the day that I tweeted today was actually huyayeomar, which is sadness of the mind or sorrowful minded. And I was curious about whether that's always there for alliteration. So, you know, Old English poetry works using alliteration. So obviously part of the reason to have a compound word would be so you could put a compound at the beginning that matches the alliteration in the line.
Yeah.
But then you also get, as you're saying, like compound words for emotions that it seems like it's more than that. It feels like it's expressing a particular kind of joy or sadness. I was looking at the word wunayamor. It means friend sorrowful. And that can't just be there for alliteration. Like, why would you choose to do that? It's clearly a specific kind of sorrow that has to do with friendship or kinsmen or something like that.
Yeah, and I think it's so specific in that way where you have there's friend joy or there's family joy or kin joy or there's feast joy. And we all know the difference between what those things are, but it's kind of fallen out of our use, even though English has so many words that mean different shades of the same thing.
Yeah.
But those compounds, they're so cool. Are there other ones that jump out to you as being some of your favorite combinations of words? Because you have a bunch in here. We have like...
I do have a bunch.
Joy.
It's escaping my mind now.
I know. I'm going to put you on the spot there. Yeah. The problem with having a book full of words is that if you ask about specific words, it can be tricky.
Yeah. There's a lot of ones with lava as well. There's mode lava, sort of like heart love. But then there's other compounds like over lava, which is sort of more love than you should have in a way.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's ones like that.
Yeah, love is a good one too, because you mentioned that one of the compounds is sorrow love, which I think we've all felt.
Yeah.
Over love. But there is a difference between things like mind love and spirit love being, you know, something between people who are brothers and sisters in faith, mm-hmm. which is something that you see quite a lot mm-hmm. in Old English. So I love these compound words together.
Yes.
Now, there's a difference between compound words and kennings. Can you tell us what kennings are?
Kennings are another one of my favorite things about Old English. I have a lot of favorite things about Old English, I guess, but I really love kennings a lot. It's when you take two nouns and put them together in a word, but it's a bit like a riddle. So the nouns on their own sort of don't have to do with the new word you're creating. I really love waverganga. It means weaver walker, and it actually means spider, which mm-hmm. is a delightful way to describe a spider. I don't even like spiders that much, but I like that word so much that that kind of makes me love them a bit more.
I thought the same thing reading that passage.
Yeah, and then there's many that describe the sun, which are really beautiful, like swail candle, so sky candle, or haven candle, heaven candle. These metaphorical compounds, they come up in Old Norse poetry as well. They're a thing with Old Norse as well, but I really wish we used them still in modern English.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example. The sun example is a good one for the difference between compound words and kennings, because there is a word for sun,
yeah.
but they're using a different one because they're trying to get at a different concept or be poetic in the way that they're describing it. And yeah, it's beautiful. I remember I took a class that was strictly Beowulf. I learned it from Sarah Lorette Kiefer, who we were talking about a minute ago, and it had some of the best both compounds and kennings in it, where it's talking about oceans and sky and Grendel being a monster or all of these things. There's so much ambiguity and so much richness in it, I think.
Yeah, it really struck me, actually. Yeah, the first time that I read Beowulf in the Old English as opposed to a translation, it just struck me how much more beautiful the poem was. I read Beowulf for the first time in high school, and it was in translation, and it was all right, but it felt like it was kind of just a lot of warriors fighting and being tough and all that. And it didn't really strike me as being beautiful. But then when I read it in Old English for the first time after taking a bunch of Old English classes first, you come across all these wonderful words that just gives you a different image of the world that it's in. And
It's something that you kind of have to access by digging into that language itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of my favorite, I think, descriptions of Grendel that always sticks out in my mind is they call him a shadow yanga. So like a shadow walker. And you're like, wow, like, that's
cool. Yeah, it's such a great word, such a great way to describe someone.
Yeah. And there are some points where you can't tell, like, is it Beowulf that's doing something? Is it Grendel that's doing something? Like, it's very different. Something that I think is worth mentioning too, is in terms of differences between modern English and Old English, is that the endings are different, right? So this is something that gives us some tricky words in modern English, but tell us how the endings are different and what their function is, because we have syntax now that tells us stuff. I may be throwing out too many words. Can you make this make sense?
Yeah, sure. So one of the complicated things about translating Old English poetry is that the words are not always in an order that we find logical. So today we know that if we say the cat ran from the dog or the dog ran from the cat, those are different things. We know those are two different concepts, even though the words don't change at all. And that's syntax. But Old English uses inflection, which is something that Latin uses as well, where the endings of the words change. And that's what tells you what part of speech it is. So whether something's a subject or an object or whatever. And that gives you a bit more flexibility when you're writing poetry, especially if you're relying on alliteration in your lines, because it means you can put words next to each other that maybe we wouldn't do using modern syntax, but you can still tell what parts of speech they are. But it also makes it really confusing. Sometimes the ending for one word could be similar in different parts of speech. And so then you have to dig a bit and try to figure out what it's actually saying.
Yeah. What word is this referring to? Well, then it really changes the shape and even the pronunciation of some of the words, which is why we still have like sink and sank. Now we still have drink and drank.
Yeah.
But we don't have that for all of our words in English. And so when people are learning it, it's really hard to remember which ones have that change.
It's so illogical. I'm so glad that I never had to learn English as a second language, because it's just so confusing. You have all of these I mean, you have these things that are based on Old English, but then all of the stuff that comes later are based on other languages. And it just seems so confusing. But yeah.
Yeah. But there were more, a lot more words that had that change, like sink sank and drink drank, than do now. And I think that probably fell out, maybe because French speakers coming and taking over a country that was speaking a Germanic language were like, this is too hard. Let's just do it. Let's just change our words in a way that makes more Latinate sense. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So you call your book A Word Hoard. Why did you call it that?
So a word hoard is one of my favorite words in Old English, and it only appears 7 times in Old English, but it refers to a poet's stockpile of words and phrases that they use when they're composing poetry. So the idea is that if you were composing poetry back in the day, a lot of it would have been oral poetry. And so you wouldn't be writing necessarily, you would be speaking. And we all know from, you know, speaking, trying to do public speaking, that it's helpful to have certain words and phrases in your word hoard to draw upon. It makes it easier to explain things or describe things. So that's kind of the idea with that. But I really love the idea of having a personal hoard of words that you like and that you can draw on and use. And also in Old English, word hoard usually appears next to the word unlock, which means unlock. So there's this image of unlocking your word hoard. And I kind of feel like that's what I want my book to be doing, is unlocking my personal set of favorite Old English words and to share with other people. So yeah, that's why it's called the word hoard.
Well, I like that connection between unlocking the hoard, having a hoard, but unlocking it, because one of the sections that you have in it is about gift giving, which is such a big deal in like early English culture. And we have that word hoard as in you have a hoard, and we have hoard as in hoarding things. So how does this work in Old English? Because you talk a lot about hoarding and gifting. How do you think that works kind of culturally and linguistically?
Yeah, well, something that we see a lot in Beowulf especially is like when you receive gifts, it's not a good idea to keep them. That usually is, it leads to bad things happening. If you're given a gift, then you pass it on to someone else. And there's this idea of reciprocation. So a good king would be distributing wealth to his followers in return for their loyalty and their fighting for him. If a king just hoards wealth, keeps it all for himself, then that's not going to lead to this healthy sort of relationship between him and his people. I guess that's maybe one reason why the dragon is not a great figure, not a real positive figure in Old English poetry, because the dragon sits on the gold hoard and doesn't share the wealth, but doesn't really do anything with it either, just sort of has it, keeps it for itself. Towards the end of Beowulf, there's this moment of Beowulf dying because he was killed by the dragon in the final battle. Spoiler alert if no one has read Beowulf before. But yeah, there's this gold hoard that's left behind, all the treasure that the dragon has acquired now, I guess, belongs to the Geats, but what good does it really do now that their king is dead and there's the distribution isn't going to happen anymore? It's been halted by this. So yeah, always share your hoard. That's the advice.
That's right. This book is here to be unlocked. Unlock the hoard. Well, I wanted to bring up hoarding and hoards and gifting and stuff like that, because I think a lot that's reflected in the language and you have in the book too is this idea of being social. Like being alone is not the best idea. And that's a real cultural thing. Can you talk a little bit about aloneness and ideas of community in Old English as a language and a culture?
Well, one of the interesting things I think is that people who are alone, they have wolves for friends in Old English. Mm-hmm. And that's basically saying that they don't have any human friends and that their only companions are these untrustworthy beings that are likely to eat them at some point. There's this idea that nowadays we might enjoy having alone time, time to ourselves, time to reflect, but in this society, it was really important to have allies and to be part of a community. And that was essential for survival. Even looking at the legal system, it's good to have people who can vouch for you. You know, if you get into a spot of trouble, then not everyone will turn against you. So Grendel is often referred to sort of as Anyanga or like a lone walker. Characters like that are seen as there's something not quite right with them, because either they want to be alone, which is very strange, because why wouldn't they want to have friends? Or they're alone for some reason that doesn't reflect well on their personality.
Yeah, why doesn't this person have any friends?
Yeah.
What's wrong with them? Yeah, I think that it's good that you mentioned that we value it a lot more now than we did back then. But I mean, it's a survival thing. But I think that's really reflected in the language and the way that works together, you know? And one of the things that you mentioned in the book too is being alone has a lot to do with like a sadness. Being alone is really sad. And there's actually a lot of sad old English poetry.
There is. Yeah, it's not the happiest collection of poetry. Yeah. Although sometimes like the loneliness can also be signaling some kind of a personal strength as well. You see these saints who decide to go be hermits. That's the choice that they make, to isolate themselves from other humans. And it's not because there's something wrong with them. It's because they have the moral strength that they can go out and face demons on their own. And then you get characters, like the panther in the poem that's known as The Panther. The panther's described as a creature that walks on its own. It's by itself. But the panther is symbolic of Christ in this literature. So clearly that's supposed to be a positive character. But at the same time, that character is isolated. There's no one quite like the panther, I guess.
Yeah, because no one would want to choose that for themselves, right?
Yeah.
Why would you want to be by yourself? That's what makes it such a tough choice. And wow, why they're saints that are going out and being hermits. Yeah, so this idea of a sadness around old English poetry and stuff, do you think that is a cultural thing, that's the way that they are talking about the world? Or you think that is something that's kind of a cultural thing? Like they think of things as being hard and joy as being something that is a bright spot in the darkness. Like, how do you think this works in this? As somebody who studies the language, how do you think that works in the culture?
Yeah, the sadness, the feelings of sadness that we get a lot are in, I mean, more literary works. So I don't know if it is a reflection of people just being miserable all the time. I don't think that's the case. But the fact that they're focusing on the sad emotion, that maybe that was more touching or meaningful. It's also important to think about how the here and now is just a step on the way to eternal happiness in heaven. And so a lot of that joy that we talked about earlier is sort of in thinking about heaven, and there's going to be a lot of joy later on. So maybe it's also a way of thinking about the hard things in your life right now. You have to deal with this sadness and these difficulties, but it will get better later. I don't know if that really answers your question, but
yeah, well, I was just asking your thoughts on it. So yeah, definitely. But I think that is a good point in that much of the literature that we have, and we don't have all that much in relative terms.
Yeah.
It's coming from a time when there is this conversion to Christianity, and a lot of stuff being written is written with a Christian lens. And that is kind of basically things are depressing here, but wait until later. So it's interesting to me to see, again, how this works, this kind of collision between old ideas and new ideas of Christianity, how it's being established and how people are thinking about it. So yeah, I wanted to ask what you thought about.
Yeah. And I mean, there is literature too that is definitely not sad. It's even silly. I mean, the Exeter Book Riddles, for instance, they're a collection of riddles. Some of them are more deep and meaningful and spiritual than others, but some are just, they're just silly. Like they're clearly meant to make you think of something dirty or raunchy and then be like, no, that was just you thinking that. It really was this other thing. So there's humor. There's definitely humor in Old English as well, even though it does seem like there's a lot of sadness primarily.
Yeah, I mean, those riddles are great. They're really putting that focus back on you, like, get your mind out of the gutter. What I was talking about was an onion, of course. Yeah, I love that. So when I was first learning Old English, one of the things that was pointed out to me was a place where you see Old English remnants today tends to be like really ordinary, like down on the level of the farm type words, whereas the Latinate words are usually things that are maybe a little bit more sophisticated, and this perhaps is a remnant of the Normans taking over and being the higher class. I mean, I wouldn't say that is true today. 1,000 years later, I think it's all mixed up. But there are some really basic Old English words that still live today. Are there some examples that you like? I mean, I'm thinking about like animals, household objects.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like farm animals, you have a coo, you have a chicken, you have a sheep. Those all sound quite similar to the words we have today. But I think a lot of people have sort of heard that when the animals are still on the farm, they're cows and pigs and whatever. But then once the animals get to the table, they're called veal and pork and beef. There's this sort of divide between these words that are from Old English that are, I guess, more agricultural, and then these words that are used for high society, you know, eating meat at a feast, putting food on the table that is more of a Norman influence.
Do you think it's mostly food, or you think that is kind of across the board with things like buildings and technology as well? I mean, because we do have words like house, which are Old English words. We have words like oven, which are Old English words. But I'm not sure that it has lasted with that hierarchy still in place all the time.
Yeah, I'm not sure about other examples, because there's some, like as you say, there's a lot of really common words that we still use, like, I mean, house and word. But yeah, I'm not sure exactly how come certain words became more influenced by the French and how that took over. I mean, one of the examples that I talk about, I guess, earlier on in my book is dome for judgment. And now we talk about judgment, but the Old English word for it is dom, D-O-M, and we still have doom in our vocabulary. But why did we start using judgment instead? Is it maybe because the Norman influence in the court of law, and that word came in that way? So there's different situations, I guess, you could see maybe there would be a reason for the Norman version to have more prominent use.
I think if we had a time machine, the people themselves wouldn't really know.
I don't know. We just like that word better.
I don't know. It just sounded good. Well, and you know, part of it might be that you have all of this intermixing, and following the grammatical rules of Old English might be pretty difficult. So there are some words that have kind of come back around accidentally, and the word I'm thinking of is unfriend. And I really like this Old English idea of you have a word like friend, and then you make it bad by just adding un.
So I like love that too.
Unfriend, untruth, but there's even ones like unweather.
Unweather, which it's really funny, because I think usually when we're talking about weather today, it's often in a negative sense, or maybe that's just from living in the UK. When people talked about it, it was usually in a negative sense, not so much in Canada. But the fact that unweather is by definition bad weather means that weather has to be probably good weather. And there are words like weather talking, which is weather sign, and it's not a weather sign in Old English. It's not a dark cloud. It's actually the beautiful sunshine. So there are a lot of words like that that just are sort of negating something else and making it good or bad, which is interesting.
Well, and you mentioned that unfriend is something that went out of style and came back into style kind of just coincidentally. Like people just threw that un in there as natural English speakers, not realizing it's a throwback. I think it's funny how we try and shape our language today. Like I was thinking about compound words, and today we don't put compound words together so much as we try and squish them together like brunch.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So it's interesting how it's being shaped now. Are there any Old English words that you'd like to bring back? Unweather,
unweather. I like untima as well. So there's tima, which is time, and untima, which is the improper time to do something. And we still have the word untimely, but we don't have untime. And I don't know why, because that seems like a really useful word to me, untime.
Yeah.
I don't know. Having a word like that come back would be great. I think we should still call bats priadomus, which is adorned mouse, because why wouldn't you describe a bat as an adorned mouse? It's so adorable.
Like a caped mouse. I love it.
Yeah. Brings this whole new meaning to Batman, you know?
I suppose we should end with your discussion of last word, which is something you have at the end of the book. And I thought it was really beautiful. So what does last word mean? Does it just mean the final word? What does it mean?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, that it's actually referring to one's reputation. So it's the words that people will say about you after you're gone, actually. And last can mean track, as in the track someone leaves, like the footsteps that someone leaves behind them. It was an idea that was really important too, it seems, from what we read in Old English poetry, is the importance of leaving behind a good reputation, having people keep telling your stories after you're gone.
I love that, leaving behind a last word.
Yeah.
And your last words, I think it means something deeper and perhaps more thoughtful. So I really like that. I like that you ended the book like that. So it's a good place to leave the podcast as well.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Hannah. It was so nice to talk to you about this.
Oh, thanks. It was a lot of fun.
To find out more about Hannah's work, you can follow her on Twitter at Hannah Vidin or at OE Word Horde. To find out more about her book, her app, or how you can support her on Patreon, please visit oldenglishwordhorde.com. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on this week, Peter?
Hey, well, I finally finished my list of the 50 most important people of the Middle Ages. So
yeah.
It's the authoritative list for everyone to follow.
It's a starting place for sure. I think it's going to cause a lot of discussion, which is great.
Yeah, I hope it's interesting. I hope it's debatable. You'll see the favorites like Charlemagne and Marco Polo and Joan of Arc. They're all on the list. You know, I've got stuff like a Japanese monk, an Arabic singer I've got on the list, and I have one Viking warlord.
Nice. Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to reading that, man.
Thanks. So I've got that. We've got also pieces on why we all eat white bread. It goes back to 7th century England and missionaries.
I need to read that too.
So we got that. And we're also catching up on the story of Harald Hardrada. So we have two pieces just talking about his adventures in Sicily and his adventures in Bulgaria.
Wow, that's a great spread of topics. I love it.
Thanks.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of Medievalist.net's patrons on Patreon.com for all your support. Patrons can access all sorts of amazing nerdy stuff like subscriptions to the Medieval Magazine and Medieval World Magazine, formerly known as Medieval Warfare, as well as a book club and exclusive maps by Tina Ross. Patronage directly funds this podcast as well as Medievalist.net's other work, so thank you. To get in on the action, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from words to wards, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sapolsky, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.